The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way. Where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
Chicago's a rock band. Pantera's a rock band. But, like, people don't piss on Peter Cetera for not being, for not singing like Phil.
Dave's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, some albums you may not even know existed, and some new, or at least new to us, artists we think you should take note of. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and on this episode of Abandoned Albums, I sit down to talk with singer-songwriter Chris Canterbury.
We're like the bullies of the world, you know? We're like Jack Palance in the movie Shane, throwing the pistol at the sheepherder's feet.
Pick it up.
I don't want to pick it up, mister. You'll shoot me.
Pick up the gun.
Mister, I don't want no trouble, huh? I just came downtown here to get some Hard Rock candy for my kids, some gingham for my wife. I don't even know what gingham is, but she goes through about 10 rolls a week of that stuff. I ain't looking for no trouble, mister.
You all saw him. He had a gun.
Chris is one of those rare singer-songwriters, which is to say that his songs have a real and often relatable impact on the listener. And even in the unrelatable, there's a familiarity to his characters. And that's a skill shared by very few modern songwriters. Besides having the best album name I've heard in years, his new album, Quaalude Lullabies, offers up about 40 minutes of songs about self-reflection, the death penalty, heartache, and kitchen table poets. Produced and written by Canterbury, the 9 songs on Quaalude Lullabies prove there is still a place for heartfelt, character-driven songs. Here's my conversation with singer-songwriter Chris Canterbury.
You grew up in Louisiana, is that correct?
I did. I grew up in Haynesville, Louisiana. It's a MapDOT town, about 50 miles northeast of Shreveport, right on the Arkansas state line.
What did you listen to growing up, and who were your influences, both stylistically as you're playing guitar and lyrically?
I didn't pick up a guitar till I was in between, like 19 years old, 19 or 20. Had never played one. I listened to music, but I wasn't into any kind of music. I didn't sing or anything like that. By the time that I started becoming a musician, I had already started listening to, I'd already went through my shitty music phase.
We're going to have to dive into that one.
But I listened, like, I was, when I, so when I was younger, when I was little, I listened to, like, what my parents listened to. My dad listened to, like, light rock and some country. My mom was pretty diehard George Strait fan. My grandparents, like, we listened, my grandfather, my dad's dad was a preacher. Then my mom's dad, my other grandpa, was like the music director in a Baptist church. So we, like, listened to a lot of gospel music. I love the melodies, it's probably just that whole, it's like comfort food. It's a familiar melody. I guess what like shaped me into like music wise, like what I like to, you know, what I play and what inspired me to play. I would have friends here and there. A buddy of mine in high school turned me on to Taj Mahal, which was like, and it was odd. It was just like, it was an odd pairing. He was like, yeah, this guy's really cool, man. Listen to this. And then, like the first record I ever bought was "What's the Story, Morning Glory" by Oasis.
Yeah, okay.
I'm the world's largest. I'm an Oasis evangelical. I guess it's like I will argue the merits of that to anyone. I guess when I got to college, there was some of my friends were in college had some old folk records. When I was introduced to Guy Clark and John Prine, and I dove into stuff like Kris Kristofferson stuff that wasn't on the greatest hits album. Just like you get into like into the writing part of it, that was more like, that was kind of what started shaping. And I just like kind of lost everything else and just kind of would only like would just dive into that kind of stuff.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Try as I might to see the dark in the back of my eyes. There's an army inside my head and a monster under my bed. Numb my mind, I don't wanna lose. Heart only breaks when you use it. All the things I don't want to see. The devil, the demon, and the dark side of me.
Where did you record the record?
There's a little studio here in Nashville called Farmland Studios. Okay. It's an old house. It's got a really cool vibe. It's got a really good sound.
How long did you spend recording? Was it a lengthy process for you? Because you produced it yourself, correct?
Yeah. The actual recording part of it we did it in 3 days, I think. I mean, it might, yeah, three days. It took a little bit, and it took a few more months to get it mixed, and then about a month to get it mastered. Technically, it's not a very in-depth record. Like, I wanted it to be simple enough to get the point across, but also like not, I don't, I didn't, but I also didn't want it to be super production heavy.
The album began as a thought experiment. So I'm like, all right, well, that sounds interesting. I did a quick Google search on thought experiment, and it actually is a thing. A rudimentary explanation for those is, you take and think about cause and effect, or effect and cause. So when you think about Quaalude Lullabies beginning as a thought experiment, what were you thinking about? What were you trying to solve for yourself?
I wanted to take the concept of a concept record. I guess the best way to describe it, I wanted to do something really close to Nebraska. Not something that could be compared to Nebraska in any means, just something, the idea that like it's this like box of like bedroom demos that are just 100, you know, like 100% real. There's no outside influence on them.
Sure.
Like, I wanted to do that, and I wanted to basically present it in that kind of, like I said, that like, I like to think that these songs are presented as like casual, like Saturday morning, a kitchen conversation. That conversation that you have, like on the spur of the moment, that's what I want these songs to come across as.
I grew up in the 70s. That's when drugs were drugs, man. We did them all, goddammit. We did every fucking drug there was to be had. We did them all. We did stuff people don't even do anymore. Like lewds. Remember lewds? Lewds, man. Fucking lewds, man. Call up the lewds, dude. Fucking lewds. I think lewds explain why we were wearing the giant flare bell-bottom pants and the platform shoes. What do you think? I think it's the only possible explanation. There we were in the middle of a sexual revolution wearing clothing that guaranteed we wouldn't get laid. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Quaalude Lullabies. Now, Quaaludes are a very specific kind of drug that weren't even in fashion, I think, when I was in high school. And I'm curious, one, how you came up with the title and why that one?
I mean, the album's it's a collection of fucking downers.
That's a fucking great way to put it.
I pitched around the idea of titling the album "Devil, the Dealer in Me," but I just kind of thought "Quaalude Lullabies" was a better title. I grew up in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
And I remember a friend of mine finding a bottle of like expired Quaaludes that just.
I've done my share of chemicals, and I know I took one once, and I was probably a freshman in high school, and I have no recollection of the impact on me, you know? But I do know that it is a downer. What's weird about Quaalude Lullabies is that, sure, it might be a little bit down, and there's a certain sense of loneliness, but I don't, maybe this says more about me, but I don't find them sad. The characters are sad. I didn't feel they were like epically sad. I didn't feel that they were like tragic characters. They're characters living in their own lives. I didn't get a sense of tragedy. Is that a fair statement?
No, 100%. And that's a great, and like you're the first person to really pick up on that idea that it's like, it's not self-biographical. It's not anything like that. It's a collection of stories with damaged characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, that's the whole, like, I think that's kind of how I see, songwriting. That's how I see songs come into my head as like miniature movies with like characters with like backstories and like in certain locations. There's for instance, I put like the town of Texarkana in two songs on this record, and I've had two more songs where I've had that I've written that I've mentioned Texarkana, and I don't, other than my brother and sister-in-law living there, I don't have any connection to the place. It sings well, and when I've gone through there, it seems like a cool place to have a. It's a D-market town that needs a song, you know, that needs to have its name in songs. So
I read in your bio there was a note of Springsteen's Nebraska, and I think there's an element of that here in the characters that we're talking about. And what's interesting is you said these aren't autobiographical songs, right? And the funny thing is about Springsteen, he's never worked a factory in a day in his life. All the characters he's created are just in his head. That's the beauty of songwriting when you do it well.
Well, thank you. And that's kind of you hit the nail on the head. If I wrote songs just for me, they'd all be kind of boring. take stories, you take like ideas, take, you know, things that you've remembered about these other stories, like other people's stories that you hear. Like, it might be a story that you overhear in a bar, like literally, like I think, I've had songs that have come around, just like, I overheard a story. I'm like, that's kind of cool. But the people telling the story were kind of lame. Why don't we soup it up a little bit? On my last record, there was a song on Refinery Town. There was a song on there called Broken Man. And it's about, and like when I play the song out, like I say, it's a song about my daddy robbing a liquor store, because it's told from the first person standpoint. And my dad never robbed a liquor store, obviously. The song literally came from, the idea came from reading an article in Newsweek in the dentist office back right after the financial crisis. The story was about this mill worker from Lawrence, Kansas, who got laid off, went around the corner, robbed a convenience store, and then went to the Walgreens down the street and bought diapers and the baby formula.
Oof.
And that's like, it's real shit. You know what? That's a love song. That's real love. is what that is.
What did you study in college?
I was an English major.
Oh, all right. Very cool. Very cool.
That's the degree you get when you want to either going to be a teacher or you're going to be unemployed.
Well, or a singer-songwriter.
Right.
That explains the literary bend of your writing, because it is really, really picturesque writing. I am curious about one thing. There is only the one cover on the record, right?
Yeah.
Yellow Mama. Why that one? And I guess a little preface for those listening, it's in reference to the electric chair, correct?
Yeah, it is. It's a Will Cambrough song, and I wish I could remember the name of the EP that he put it on. It came out. He put it out on a little acoustic EP about 12 or 13 years ago, I think. It's Yellow Mama is the nickname of the Alabama electric chair, and the first time I heard the song was, I can't remember. I feel like I heard his version, and then I heard Cody Canada from Cross Canadian Ragweed play it one time, and it just kind of stuck with me. And I kept looking for it, and I think there was, at the time that it came out, like you, there wasn't any, like, any, even videos of it on YouTube or anything you could find anywhere. And none of the streaming sites, like Spotify was, I think Spotify was around, but I don't think it was on there. Like, I found it like on a deep web search one night. And I found it, like, and I, like, downloaded a version of it. It's like, learned it. And so then I was like, okay, if I can't find this to listen to anywhere else, I might as well just, like, start playing it so I can remember it. And so I did, and I hadn't played it. I hadn't played it in years. And when I was trying to figure out songs to put on the record, I kind of wanted to do one that was kind of bluegrassy, I guess, in a sense. I want string bandy. And then my good buddy, Anthony Saddick, is who you hear play accordion on that track. And I was really trying to figure out a song where I could feature an accordion on. And when I thought about that one, I was like, well, we'll give it a shot and see what it sounds like. And then I think we ran it three times and picked the second one. And I was like, I love the way it turned out. So I put it on the record.
Yeah, it's great. And, the intro is fun too. It's like, I believe it's a woman. She says, you want to try it one more time? Yeah. That's great. It's a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, it is. That's Meg McCree. She did harmony vocals on the whole record. Did an amazing job. Was exactly what it needed for the, like, to balance out the vocal end on the record.
Shall we try una más? Go. Cool.
One, two, three, one, two. I know I done wrong, I know I must pay. Yellow mama, have mercy on me. I sat in this cell for 1,000 days. Yell, mama, have mercy on me. The appeals have run out and the governor won't bend. Yell, mama, have mercy on me. I done did the time, now here comes the end. Yell, mama, have mercy on me. Yellow 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 mama, have mercy on me.
A few weeks ago, one of the guys I interviewed was Paul Mahern, who's a member of Zero Boys, which is a punk band. And he's also a producer engineer, worked a lot with John Mellencamp. And he posed this theory of, which is Brian Eno's theory, the senius, which is sort of no one person makes it on their own. You know, there's a scene usually around people.
Oh, totally.
Do you find that to be the case for yourself there? Is the theory of senius applicable for you in Nashville?
There's no way I could do this without an infrastructure. And if there wasn't an infrastructure, there would be no reason to be here. When people say they're moving to Nashville, I feel like that's what they're moving for. Like, they're moving here for the scene, for the groups, for, like, the in groups, for the networking. I've heard people say that like, this town, it's really easy to get discouraged here when you first move to town, because you get here and you realize that there's 100,000 other of you trying to do exactly what you're trying to do. But if you stay for a year, then you've outlasted 90,000 of those people that were here when you got here. When I got here, I was a small fish in a big pond, kind of thing. It was overwhelming. And then after being here for a few months, I'm like, man, there's 100,000 other of me here, but I seem to give a shit more than 99,000 of them. There's also the fact that it's like the kind of music that I write and play is different than most of the people that are here writing songs.
A friend of mine was telling me a number of years ago when he lived in Nashville that there were people, musicians would gather at other musicians' house and have sit-arounds and play guitar and sing songs and hootenannies.
Yeah, man. There's still pockets of, you know, pockets of that. there's a group of kids, and I keep saying kids, but I mean, they're half my age, but they're also old enough to drink, so they're not really kids anymore.
I'll fix the desk, Mr. Edmonds. I'll sand it down and refinish it. You won't be able to tell where I scratched it at all.
That's a good idea, Jim.
I'll begin today after school.
That would be fine.
Well, what else do you want me to do, Mr. Edmonds?
Perhaps you can help me with a problem. I'd like your advice, Jim.
My advice?
Yes, I've got quite a serious problem. There are a great many young people in the school, Jim. Each is an individual, but in one important way, they're all alike. They're all growing up.
There's a group of very talented younger musicians who are in the kind of an underground, who are in kind of the underground country scene that have, like, in my eyes, they've kind of taken that torch from your, like, Guy Clark's, Rodney Crowell's, the, like, that group of, that was from Heartworn Highways that sat around the kitchen table at Christmas.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah, it's a cool little group. I tell them sometimes when they ask me to come out and play, that I'm proud that they'll have an old man like myself come in and sit in with them.
Those whippersnappers, a thing or two.
Yeah.
I was listening to the record with a friend of mine, and he mentioned, I wonder what he thinks about outlaw country.
I mean, I'm not gonna talk shit about anything like that. That's there's some of that stuff. I wouldn't call it outlaw. I'd just call it country music. You start putting a label on it like that, and it becomes a box, an even smaller box that you have to stay in.
All these other labels we attach to it are oftentimes just marketing ploys, you know, and it does make it easy for people to process. But, you know, at the end of the day, for me, you got jazz, you got classical, you got rock, you got country, you got blues.
Yeah. 100%. It's like there's this whole thing in country music about saying something's not country. Well, that's not country. Well, what they're playing on the radio is not country. You see, country is a wide swath of music.
If the Eagles came out today, they would probably be a country band.
Oh yeah, 100%. And not a radio station in the world would play Hotel California because it's too fucking weird.
So let me ask you about Kitchen Table Poet. I was a bartender when I lived in Danbury, and one of the guys I worked with didn't smoke, but he would collect Marlboro Miles. So your line about junk drawer full of Marlboro Miles, a sailor's mouth and a preacher's smile. To me, that there's so much imagery in that. You know, I have a reference point. This guy, who was a giant bald guy, who would collect all these things. And in particular, a sailor's mouth, which spot on, right? Because I curse like a fucking sailor, right? And a preacher's smile. It's just that twist. It's so, so good. And the fact that here's a guy, and you say as much. We're never going to know him.
I started the song. I wrote the song with my buddy Monty Russell from Ruston, Louisiana. And like when I first started writing it, before I pitched it to him, like I knew I wanted to write it with him because he's a very, like, he's working on a Southern Gothic play right now kind of thing. Like he's a very kindred spirit kind of fella. I spent the night at a little like a hostel slash like boarding house in outside of Auburn, Alabama. It's called the Standard Deluxe House. Me and my buddy Channing Wilson played a gig, and it's a cool place. I mean, it's a poster shop. It's just kind of this cool little Waverly, Alabama. It's just a cool little town, man. The gig was on a Friday night, and I got up on the Saturday morning. I woke up early. It's probably 7:30. You know, probably 7:30, and walked outside, and there was this old man on the porch. I had no idea who he was. He said he lived across the street. He was making coffee and trying to find the radio station that was going to have the Auburn game on. And he was like smoking cigarettes. He couldn't find it. He put his lighter down. He couldn't find it. And like, I sat there and talked with him for probably 3 hours. And just like, he just told me story after story. He said he'd never left the county, but he also made the best apple brandy in the state. And like I'd go to challenge him on how he knew, and he didn't, like, he would change the subject. but he had these like one liners, like these little like quips or whatever, and it made me think. It was like, man, he could turn a phrase like an AM dial.
Yeah.
From there, I was like, I had the first verse kind of knocked out when I pitched it to Monty, and he was all in on it, and so we finished it up. And And I was like, we were trying to figure out the hook. And I was like, man, it's like, what was that guy's name? What was that guy's name? And it just hit me. It was like, hell, you won't ever know his name.
He had a junk drawer full of Marlboro miles, a sailor's mouth and a preacher's smile. He'd say, y'all come in, won't you stay a while? And he'd turn a phrase like an A.M. dial. An old wooden chair with a million scratches, from opening beers to striking matches, on the leg or the seat every time he catches rhyme or a line between the ashes. He's a kitchen table poet. He's a danger with a phrase, a rounder and a founder of a once forgotten age. His words flow like whiskey through fibers on the page. But he's a kitchen table poet. Won't ever know his name.
I do want to talk about, I've seen a picture of the album cover on your website. Is that really the album cover? Because it's fucking cool.
Yeah, it is. If it's the one where my face is like, I'm looking over to the side, it's got my name. Yeah,
that's it. Yep. It's like a classic old album cover.
Yeah, thanks, man. That's I'd like to thank my wonderful design team. For myself for that. That's the good thing about like doing these, about having that skill in my pocket, and that, and like my girlfriend's a photographer, so she took the pictures, and it's like it saved me being able to do that work has saved me like probably $10,000 to $15,000 on this project.
A hell of a project. And has the response been much like what I'm giving you now? I mean, I have to imagine people aren't just blowing smoke up your ass, because I'm not.
That's what somebody blowing smoke up my ass would say, Keith.
Fuck.
No, man, totally, 100%. I didn't expect a negative response, but I expected less of a positive response than what I've gotten. But I have absolutely been overwhelmingly positive responses.
So well deserved. It's just a really great record. I don't remember the last time where I've stopped dead. I actually listened to the lyrics, man.
I appreciate that. And I feel like that's kind of my MO, like my overall MO of what I do. I just want you to listen to the words. I'm not going to write a super in-depth technical arrangement for anything. I don't have the ability to do that. Sometimes I wish I did. Like if you see my name on a record, it's going to be familiar. It's going to be melodies that you're familiar with, and hopefully a point of view that you can latch on to, mm-hmm. and either embrace or critique. I have no problem with people being critical of what I say or the concepts of what I say. But I feel like my job is done if I can make you listen to the lyrics.
Fuck yeah. And those people that take the time, I think, will be greatly rewarded.
Thanks, man.
You're touring the record now, right? Is it just you and acoustic guitar? You got a small band or?
The album comes out the 23rd, September 23rd. And I am, I'm going to do a full band release. And then I'm taking off on the road for an acoustic run.
Because I live in the Northeast, I noticed there were no Northeast dates. You got Boston, you got Providence, you've got New York, Philadelphia. It's all along 95.
I was trying to work on some Northeast dates towards the, but they got a little further into, the year than I was looking to come up that far north.
Yeah.
But I'm working on a few dates in that area for 2023. probably early 2023, or at least when most of the snow melts.
It doesn't make sense to come up here in the winter.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense to go to Louisiana in the middle of the summer. It doesn't make sense to come there in the dead of winter.
Agreed.
I made that mistake last year going to Chicago in January.
Oh no!
I think when I woke up the morning after the gig I played, it was negative 15. It felt like negative 50. With the wind.
I've never understood that. Like, so it's negative 15. That's fucking cold. Why do you got to add the wind chill? It feels like it's negative 50. Well, negative 15 is cold enough. Thank you. I don't need to know what it feels like.
Yeah, it was bad. It was really, really bad.
Have you played New York City?
I did. I played in October of 2019. There was a little festival there. It's called Mondo Fest, I think. And the label that I was on at the time was Chicken Ranch Records out of Austin. But he had a showcase for it and had me come up. And we played in Brooklyn, a place called Teddy's, the oldest operated bar in Brooklyn, I think.
I used to live right around there. I know exactly where that is.
That is the coolest. Like, that is one of the. That's one of the coolest places I've ever played. It was like five people there. Like, nobody showed up for it, but it was the little room off to the side that was like an old speakeasy room is where I played. And it was like, it was a good thing only five people showed up because it was super small and maybe 10 would have filled it up.
This is apropos of nothing, but I am going to ask it. Have you seen the Ken Burns documentary about country music?
I have not, but it's one of those things that like, you're not the first person to ask me. And every time I say, I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch that. And then I never do, but I'm going to watch that.
You never will, Chris. You never will.
What's going to happen is it's going to be, I'm going to like download it to my phone and then I'm going to be on a flight somewhere and like be out of stuff to watch. I'm like, oh, okay. We'll watch this now.
Yeah, man.
And it's going to be awesome. And I'm going to like, and then I'm going to like tell everybody about it. And
the depth at which he goes into the historical context and the way he lays out country music is so fucking amazing and interesting. For me as a music fan, I'm not a musician, and you know, and candidly, country, I grew up with it. My mom loved it, but I was a rock and roll guy. I still am. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch it but wow, it's fucking fascinating. I think you'd really, really enjoy it. It's so much, and everything's fucking connected. Rock and roll, obviously rock and roll is connected to country.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just fascinating the way he puts it all together.
You've pitched it more than anybody else has. So you might actually get me to watch it now.
Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. Thank you for the record. And I'm really, really excited. I'm going to pre-order my vinyl. Does it come with a lyric sheet?
Anybody that's listening to this podcast wants to order a vinyl and you want to message me and I'll throw a lyric sheet in there with it.
You heard it. Cause I'm going to ask for it.
I'm not going to hand write one for you.
But no, I wouldn't expect that.
But you'll,
it adds to the experience of listening the type of songs that you're writing for me. And that's selfish but fuck it.
No, I totally get where you come from. I'll go print some out. I got a printer. So okay. If anybody's listening to the, Abandoned Albums podcast, and you order a vinyl, you pre-order one, or you order one, just put in a note that you want a lyric sheet, and I'll throw you one in there.
I will do that, and as will the people who actually listen to the record first, and they're going to be like, what the fuck? They got to get this. I'm looking forward to seeing you in the Northeast in early 2023, so I hope you make it up. And I'm wishing you much, much success with this record and the tour, because I'm not really one for hyperbole. There was something special about listening to your record that struck me, and it really, really hit me hard. So thank you.
No, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me on, for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Take care, Chris.
Hey, all right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Many thanks to Chris for stopping by Thunder Love Studios and having a chat. The songs you heard during this podcast were all taken from Chris's album, Quaalude Lullabies, and they were The Devil, The Dealer, and Me, Yellow Mama, and Kitchen Table Poet. You can stream Quaalude Lullabies as well as Chris's other work wherever you stream your favorite music. You also heard a clip from the Bill Hicks album, Arizona Bay, and the Dennis Leary album, No Cure for Cancer. Special thanks to Josh Zanger. Please be sure to check out the episode notes. We'll have links there for all the stuff that you're probably scratching your head about now. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. And on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_Albums.
Grazie.
Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course, our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderwolf.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.